Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and in this episode you're going to hear about, amongst other things, dark matter, the Rosetta mission, and the Deep Space Gateway. And we'll hear from a whole host of brilliant people, including Beth Healy, Brian May, and Tim Peake. Yes, you heard me right. It's been an exciting few days for The Shed. We had the Ready Player One episode where we visited Territory Studio to find out about their stunning work on the film, our Lost in Space episode with Professor Ethan Siegel, and that Space Hotel episode where we heard from Frank Bunger, the man behind the launching of a hotel into space. Shed excitement reached orbit this week, though, because Steve and I visited Space Rocks at the O2 in London. Now, Space Rocks is the European Space Agency's new one-day celebration of all things space, music and science fiction. So, of course, we had to be there. You'll have heard our conversation with Charlotte Hatherley a few episodes back, who performed songs from her new album at the event. And the event itself was split into three sessions. The Space Academy brought Tim Peake, Beth Healy, Matt Taylor and Maggie Liu to a room packed full of families of all ages, followed by a session exploring science and science fiction right up the Cosmic Shed street before Charlotte Hatherley brilliantly opened the music in an all too brief but no less brilliant set. We'll come to all of that, but we'll begin the episode as the day began, with Dr. Maggie Liu. Maggie works on the Euclid Space Telescope, which is designed to map the dark matter in the universe. After a talk, we caught up with Maggie backstage. In the Q&A, someone asked her if she'd like to go to Mars. Maggie said that she'd love to, and would make sure that she packed some great space films for the journey. I began by asking her what she'd like to watch on her way to Mars.
So my favourite space movie from a kid was Contact. I loved it. As a kid, I looked out on the universe and thought, oh my god, like, there must be so much out there, and I just want to explore everything. I mean, from Earth, the stars look so pretty, right? And you're just like, I want to go there. Imagine, like, flying through space. I'm so jealous of Tim Peake having a great view of the Earth from the ISS. Yeah. I'd love that.
The Jodie Foster character in Contact, we had Jill Tarter on the Cosmic Shed, who's the character was based on. Was that character an inspiration to you as a young scientist?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm still, like, at ESAC, there's, like, giant antennas, and I always, like, see them moving around. I'm like, oh, I've detected some aliens. Is it listening? It isn't actually pointed at anything like that. But they're so big, it still like, fascinates me.
And does anyone listen to their washing machine for patterns?
No. But in Australia, one time, they had their giant antenna, right? And they thought they detected something really cool, something really interesting. Turned out, they correlated it. It happened every day at, like, about 12:30-ish. And then later they figured out actually it was the microwave.
So you're working on the Euclid mission. Uh-huh. Right? Can you tell us a bit about that?
So Euclid is a 1.2-meter space telescope, and it's going to go to L2. So it's not like Hubble. Hubble's like around here. L2 is quite far out. So if anything goes wrong, we can't fix it.
Just to interject briefly, L2 is a region of space a million miles from Earth in the opposite direction from the Sun. With the Earth, Moon and Sun behind the spacecraft, it can get a clear view of deep space.
It's an optical and infrared space telescope. So the idea is that it wants to measure the shapes of galaxies and also the redshift, to how far away the galaxies are.
Okay. You're studying dark matter.
Yeah. So my main research is on galaxy clusters, and so these are the largest structures that we know of in our universe, and 90% of the matter in galaxy clusters is dark matter. And mostly what I do is weak gravitational lensing. So this is when the light from distant galaxies is bent due to the gravity of the galaxy cluster and the dark matter. So instead of light traveling in a straight line when you shine a torch, for example, if the gravity of Earth was strong enough, it would bend the light and distort the shapes of galaxies. So if you can measure, like, the distortion of the galaxies behind galaxy clusters, you can figure out like how much dark matter is along the line of sight and how heavy it is, right?
Okay, but right. Something that's often said about dark matter by scientists is that we don't know what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're talking about measuring it, and you're talking about seeing how heavy it is. And mm-hmm. How can you do that if you don't know what it is?
Just through the interactions of gravity. Everything with mass is affected by gravity, and that's the same with dark matter. Dark matter has a mass, so it has a gravitational force.
Okay, and will those measurements tell you what it is, or just tell you where it is?
So what I work on, mostly where it is and how much mass it is. But there are people who are working on, for example, in my talk I talked about how colliding galaxy clusters, the stars and galaxies, they just pass through each other because they're not packed, right? They're really far apart. And so when you collide, they literally fly straight through. The hot gas in galaxy clusters, they shock because there's about 10% of a galaxy cluster that's in hot gas, and when it crashes together, it's quite dense and it shocks. Dark matter, it pretty much goes straight through each other, but it weakly interacts. And if it were to follow exactly the shocking of the hot gas, you would know that it has a large interaction surface. But if it follows exactly the galaxies, then you would know that it doesn't have any interaction or has zero interaction surface. And figuring out where the galaxies, the dark matter is, and the hot gas with respect to each other can give us a constraint on how it interacts.
Okay, so it is actually matter.
It is matter. It's something, yeah. We've been trying to find it, like on Earth, CERN, for example, colliding particles together to see if we can find dark matter particles flying out, but they haven't found anything. There's neutrino experiments where big tanks to see if dark matter flies through. Does it interact with anything? Does anything fly out? They haven't seen anything. So we really don't know. It might be that gravity is wrong, but so far it's worked really well for us, and Einstein's gravity has predicted gravitational waves, which people thought there's no way we're going to detect them, and we have. So I think it's more a matter of time.
The event was hosted by friend of the shed, Dallas Campbell. Now, Dallas has appeared on the Cosmic Shed before, notably on our Gravity Fields episode. And when I caught up with him backstage after the talks, the crew were getting everything set up for the music. So excuse the banging and cluttering you'll hear.
Hi, Dallas. Good to see
you. Hello.
Nice. This is pretty awesome.
I know. Space
Rocks.
Fun.
Yeah. You've been enjoying it?
I've loved Space Rocks. It's been great. I mean, you know, it's been a pretty kind of interstellar cast. Tim's been here. Obviously, it was great. Brian May's here, Beth Healy, Maggie Lou, everyone. It's been great. It's been nice.
And you've got your book on sale.
Well, that's the most important thing. the book is on sale. Price $16.99,
right.
I think. Why? Maybe.
Sounds
that's
enough.
Exactly. That's about right. Yeah.
Tell us about your book.
Well, it's it's been a labour of love. It's a book. Well, it's sort of history and philosophy of, I guess, of space flight. It's not really about space at all. I mean, it's kind of disguised as a space book, but it's more about some of the reasons why we've wanted to leave the planet as a species. But it's also looking at it much more from a cultural point of view, not just a scientific point of view. So there's quite a lot about art and poetry and other things in it. So it's kind of a mixtape, a big mixtape of stuff. If I was going to write the book again, it would be all different stuff as mixtapes go. So it's very much, it was a kind of period, well, it was last year, the things that I was thinking about last year. A lot of work went into the design of it and choosing some of the images. And there's a lot of images of space that people will be fairly familiar with. So we've gone for really quite obscure pictures that people will not know as well. The book has contributions from other people. So there's artists, and so some of their work is in it, and other explorers and astronauts and all kinds of people. So it's a real kind of smorgasbord of stuff. Yeah.
Sounds wonderful. Yes. Sorry, I haven't got it yet. I'll go and get it.
Go buy it right now.
Are we going to see you on TV soon?
Well, yeah, I'm doing a series on Nat Geo called Science of Stupid, which is a kind of science comedy show, which is a lot of fun. Yeah. It's basically You've Got Framed, but science. Basically, it's people doing terrible things to themselves, and we explain why. Yeah, so that.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
And other things. Yeah.
Fantastic. And have you got a festival full summer? You going to talk?
Yeah, Blue Dots. Yeah. I'm doing Blue Dot. Gravity Fields. Cheltenham. Those are the three big ones. We just did Edinburgh last week, which is wonderful. So, yeah, it'll be a summer of festivals.
Listen, what I reckon we do is we catch up at each of those festivals.
Yes, yeah.
And have another conversation.
Exactly, and I'll say, have you read my book?
No. You don't have to read it.
You don't have to read it. No, it's awesome. Tim Gregory, who's on...
I know Tim.
He reviewed your book.
Oh, right, yeah.
Well.
Yeah, nice. Good. Well, he's a man of excellent taste.
Isn't he? Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's a different space book. It's not, you know, I'm not interested in facts and figures particularly. I'm not interested in the kind of, well, I am, but I, you know, the stamp collecting angle of space, you know, people knowing this date and that date. I'm much more interested from a much wider perspective, a much wider cultural perspective. So we're
going to Gravity Falls. You know, we did the Apollo 11 camp.
Yes.
So we've got a new show called The Lesser Sun, which is all about our fascination with the moon. So you'll have to come and see it.
Well, there's a lot about the moon in my book. I start with Frau Imond takes a big place in my book, and also Agnes Brandis Meyer, the German artist, who did a whole thing based on the moon goose, the ganser. Bishop Francis Goodwin in the 1600s imagined these geese that would pull us to the moon. You tie strings around them and then they'd migrate between the earth and the moon. And she did this whole reimagined version of that. And so that plays a big part. And obviously I talked to Al Warden in the book a lot. He obviously went to the moon. So I tie all these sort of facts and fiction and real and imagined adventures all together. The moon is an interesting place. There's a lot of interesting stuff on the museum. The moon as a museum, as a place where artifacts still reside, is interesting. So there's all, the moon is a fascinating sort of canvas for us.
Do you think there's going to be a day when we set foot on the moon again?
Yes.
And there'll be, as in there is the Artemis,
yeah,
there's a museum of the Apollo 11 museum.
Well, yeah. Well, I write about this. NASA published a document in 2011, which was about advice for spacefaring nations about how to treat the artifacts that are on the moon. Please don't muck up the footprints. Please don't take the flags. Please don't, you know, climb on board the Lunokhod rovers that are still there. And so it's a really interesting, it is a really interesting idea, because in the not too distant future, in my lifetime, we will be setting foot on the moon again. Obviously, the Deep Space Gateway, the moon is our next destination. That's my agent just wheeling in my books to the merchant. A lot of books have, you know, there's a, what you can't see on this radio thing is the huge crowds.
That man's telling me to stop.
Oh, right.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. It's just Dr. May has to leave imminently. We really wanted to get a team photo with all the participating talent. So, Dallas, you're
yes.
up, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Dallas.
No worries.
Very sorry. Continue anytime.
As you heard there, Brian May was about to leave. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had one question to ask the astrophysicist guitarist from Queen, it would be, what science fiction would you recommend?
I would say a book written by an eminent real astronomer, Fred Hoyle, and he didn't write much fiction, but he wrote this thing called The Black Cloud, which was really, really original in the fact that this black cloud came and enveloped certain parts of the Earth, and they didn't realise that it was actually a sentient being. So it's still an astounding thing to read, I think. Very far-seeking, you know. And it reminds us that if we're looking for life out there, it may be in a form that we really don't recognise.
Yes.
So The Black Cloud, Fred Hoyle.
Brian May there, and I wholeheartedly agree. As a massive astronomy nerd, I loved that book. And it's a real joy to read, not only from the story point of view, but just hearing about all the technology that they used in the astronomy research back in Fred Hoyle's day. But Tim Peake told us about some very up-to-date technology that will be taking us into space for real very soon.
Of course, the science on board the space station is really twofold. It's partly for the benefit of humans back here on Earth, and actually that's becoming more and more, is increasing the amount of science we're doing for the benefit of the people on Earth, because we're commercialising the space station, and that means that many companies now are involved in microgravity science and how that applies to life here on Earth. But we're also doing research for the next steps in human spaceflight and exploration. Where are we going? How can we take this further to the Moon, to Mars and beyond? And for that, of course, we're looking at the next generation of spaceflight into the 2020s. And I'm very pleased to say later this year, the European service module, the first one, actually gets delivered. This isn't PowerPoint presentations we're talking about now. This hardware is built and it's being shipped to the launch sites to be assembled and to get ready for those first missions. So this European service module has been developed from what used to be a cargo resupply vehicle that went to the space station, and it's now going to be the service module for the Orion spacecraft, which will send four astronauts to the Deep Space Gateway, which is going to be orbiting the Moon. So this is the first step working with our international partners in going back to the Moon and what will eventually end up, hopefully, fulfilling the European Space Agency's dream of a lunar habitation, Moon Village, if you like. And, of course, this is where we'll develop the tools, the techniques, the procedures and the knowledge to take us onto the next step, which is the mission to Mars.
How awesome is that? Just wonderful. And we'll hear more from Tim Peake later in the podcast. But someone who embodies that spirit of exploration is Dr. Beth Healy. You may remember Beth from our Blue Dot episode back in 2015. She's a medical doctor who has spent time in extreme environments on Earth, including seeing no sun for months in her time in Antarctica. I caught up with Beth after her talk.
What have you been doing since Blue Dot all those years ago?
I've moved out to Chamonix, so I've not got enough of the white stuff. And just generally staying involved in sort of aerospace medicine, because ultimately I'd like to work as a flight surgeon for ESA, so that's really what I'm trying to work towards. But also at the moment, so I'm just doing sort of emergency medicine and getting more experience in, again, extreme environments.
Yeah. Do they know that that's what you want to do?
Yes, they're very aware.
So when they invite you to this, you're like, yeah.
I'll come, yeah, of course. I mean, for me, that's like the ultimate job. Yeah, I'd love to do that. So.
In your talk and then in the Q&A, you talked about losing the sun.
Yeah.
Can you just talk to our listeners about losing the sun?
Yeah, losing the sun, it was a really strange thing. It wasn't one of the things that I thought about much before I'd gone down there, but it was definitely sort of in the summer before, it was the thing that everyone was talking about, is this long period, and I hadn't quite realised before I went down there quite how long it was. So it's 105 days you go without the sun. I guess for me, like, I'd already had a lot of experience of working up in the Arctic, so I was used to already sort of 24-hour daylight, and I'd always coped really well with that. I'd always managed to keep my sleep-wake cycle normal, and so I was a little bit smug. I was like, oh, I'll be fine. And then as soon as we lost the sun, I found I couldn't sleep for the next 4 days, and it really, really affected me. So it doesn't correlate between the two, and I think that was probably the biggest challenge of all, being down there, was the effect that it did have on your sleep, because you kind of stay in this weird like hibernation state almost, because you know when you go outside you have the sun, it sort of wakes you up. You never quite wake up in the same way without it, and it was only when it came back that you really, really noticed quite the effect that it had on you. And you know, the whole base was like super excited when it came back. It only popped above the horizon for about sort of a few minutes, but immediately everyone went to the gym, everyone's really happy, we had like a little party, and really the mood suddenly just lifted as soon as you got that energy from it.
Because it's like, because you're interested in the psychology and the health of astronauts, right?
Yes.
Tim Peake was talking about the Deep Space Gateway and people walking on Mars. Like, I was talking to somebody recently who said he wasn't going to go and find a space on Mars until the Antarctic was full, right? See, because the Antarctic is a terrible place to be, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, for me, growing up, the Antarctic, for me, was always the place to explore. You know, Antarctica, you hear all the stories about Scott and Shackleton and things. But, I mean, it's no longer really the case, I suppose. And so now, for me, space really has, in many ways, become the new Antarctica of our era. So, and it reflects it in so many ways. It's not just the remoteness, but also the sort of international collaboration that you see and the use of it as a scientific platform. I think there's so many things which are similar between the two, that I think it really is just the sort of next extension. And
so, but that experience that you had where you lost the sun,
yeah, okay,
that was an alien thing for you. The people who walked on the moon, and they were there for like a few days at a time.
Yeah.
But these missions we're talking about are for months at a time.
Yeah.
And what kind of effect is that going to have on people?
I think it's going to be massive, and I think we can't underestimate the effect it will have on the crew. I think. I mean, it's difficult to say until we go, of course. I mean, we can simulate as many things as we like, but actually the mission itself will be the true thing, the true test. But I think definitely using platforms like Antarctica, using platforms like Mars 500, where you're sort of artificially isolating people, I think really are helping to sort of overcome some of the challenges that we'll face. So just really sort of highlighting key points in missions where people might be like more less likely to run into trouble, to isolate themselves, and really having an awareness of when these sort of trouble points might arrive can help us counteract them, really.
Cool. But I know you've got a job in mind, but do you want to go to Mars?
For me, it's all about the moon first. If I could get to the moon, I'd be super happy. Yeah, but I think Mars is probably the next generation after me. But I hopefully will see someone step foot on Mars within my lifetime, and that's what I hope. Yeah.
And Maggie Lou was talking about watching space movies en route to Mars, and that got me thinking how awesome it would be to watch films in space. Obviously, we watch films here inside the shed and sometimes projected onto the side of the shed, sitting out under the stars. And of course, we've done live Cosmic Sheds, which some of you have joined us at to watch science fiction films in the planetarium here in Bristol. When I caught up with Tim Peat backstage, I just had to ask him.
I assume you watch some science fiction on the International Space Station.
Yes, yeah, we've got a movie library up there, so you know we don't get much time for relaxing and stuff, but at the weekend we get some time off. And actually it's really nice to come together as a crew and watch movies as a crew. And one of the first things that Scott Kelly organised for us was the new Star Wars movie. So we watch Star Wars and also we have Alien up there, which is you know quite masochistic to sit on the space station and watch Alien, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Did you watch Gravity up there?
No, I'd seen Gravity before I launched, but I didn't watch it up there. But obviously, it's probably not the thing you want to watch the night before your spacewalk.
Absolutely. You're quite a big fan of The Abyss.
I love The Abyss. I thought it was a fantastic movie. Yeah, one of my favourites. Up there with Apollo 13.
Yeah, awesome. You didn't watch that up there?
No, neither of those.
If you go back up, do you think you would take film specifically with you to watch it? Is it different watching films?
It is if you're in a social environment. I think that was the thing. And we, you know, like I said, we really don't have much time for watching movies. And if you've got the choice of watching a movie or actually going to the cupola and taking photos of planet Earth, I would, you know, normally choose to go to the cupola and take photos. But I think it's what's really nice is to have some special movies. And you know, like watching Star Wars is completely iconic with the crew on board the space station. Had to be done.
You looking forward to the Solo movie?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Watching aliens on the International Space Station is just plain madness. It's like watching snakes on a plane. But The Force Awakens on board the ISS has to be one of, if not the coolest things I have ever heard. I had thought that my respect for Scott Kelly and Tim Peat could not get any higher. I was wrong. Quite possibly the most science fiction space mission of my lifetime was the Rosetta mission. Philae landing on that comet was just astounding. But not only did it blow my mind, but it also introduced many of us to the project scientist Matt Taylor. Matt did a phenomenal talk at Space Rocks, and I picked up the conversation where I'd left it with Tim Peat.
Are you looking forward to the Solo movie?
Yes, I am actually. And people have spoken to me about that before, but I don't think I could be not impressed with Star Wars. My bar is very low, maybe.
What, even the prequels?
I can watch them now, make sense. If I go back, so I'll start watching Rebels and things like that, because everything makes sense. Now, okay, there are some annoying things in there, and I have to say, going back and watching the whole lot, as I did for The Force Awakens, we went back and watched the whole lot. Then you're like, okay, that makes sense. Having watched Rebels as well, and watched the Clone Wars, to do the whole lot, then everything fits together. And my wife's a much bigger Star Wars geek than I am, so she's reading the books. I'm a bit slow at the moment, and it's piecing everything together. So I mean, I'd like to see more. I want to see an Obi-Wan film, to be honest with you, because there's a much better story, I think, because Han Solo's a standalone character. You didn't really need to do a film on him, but the richness of what Obi-Wan was getting on about with, what's her name, I've forgotten her name now, the head of the Mandalorian. So anyway, so there's a lot of connections there.
Yeah.
That there's a good backstory. So, and also, Ewan McGregor needs to have that film, I think. But right. Anyway, I've gone on. I like them all.
Yeah, okay. I know, that's fair enough. What's the Dutch garrison?
Through Rosetta, I got invited to give a talk at FedCon, which is a really big Star Trek based, but it's more. It's a convention in Germany. So I gave a talk on Rosetta there, and I met a couple of people. One of them, who we still kept in contact with, Fiona Messer, who was in the 501st, the German 501st garrison, so the costume club from Star Wars. And I started talking to her, and I was like, I think I should join you guys. She's like, yeah, okay. And then so I got into it from that, and I built a Stormtrooper outfit, which you saw in the talk, and then you become a member of the 501st. I'm not very, I have to say, I'm bad, because I'm not as active as I should be. My Dutch is terrible, even though I live in the Netherlands, which is a problem, because a lot of the 501st stuff is to do with going to kids, hospitals, this kind of thing. And so I find it, I don't want to scare a kid by them talking to me in Dutch and me just completely ignoring them in a plastic face. So there's a bit of a language issue there, but I have trooped with them. I've done talks, actually, and Alex was after me, the guy running this, was after me to do a talk in my outfit, but that would have meant shipping it all over me, and I didn't want to do that. But that's it. I'm basically a member of the 501st, and yeah, and that's because of Rosetta.
Right. So, as a science fiction fan, you did, I think, probably the most science you were involved in, probably the most science fiction space mission that there has been. When you were, is that not right? Do you not think there's been?
I don't know. It depends. There's probably, well, I know there are people arguing that there are things that have been bigger, better, or whatever. But for me, certainly, this was, I think Mark McCocken would say this, it came up during Rosetta that this was this generation's kind of Apollo moment. Yeah. So you had that connection with something so weird and crazy going to the unknown. So the moon landings, to me, it was at that level. Some people will argue with that, but yeah, so I think, yeah, it was a big science fiction moment.
Well, I'm not going to argue with it. That Apollo thing that you're talking about, so we've had Apollo astronauts on the Cosmic Show podcast before, and one of the things that I picked up with them, and I hope this doesn't happen to you, is that they've done that. They've been to the moon, and then the rest of their life is difficult. Do you feel like the rest of your life is difficult?
When I was offered to move on to the mission, it truly, management was saying, this will be the pinnacle of your career, that's it. And I think I knew that, but I didn't know that it was going to be like this. I don't think anyone that was on the mission knew it was going to be like this. So, yeah, everything will pan into insignificance, yeah. But and I'll be boring that I'm waiting for another mission to move on, and they'll get to work on different parts of the missions that I've never really experienced, like building the spacecraft, that kind of thing. So to me, I'll get engaged in that. But, yeah, in a way, I'm kind of glad that there isn't anything that I can at least see in the future that's anything like Rosetta. There are really fantastic missions, but there's nothing I know that I'll be involved in the short term that's going to be anything like it.
Because maybe not in the short term, but when Rosetta landed on the... Philo landed on the comet, it was 20 years old, right? The hardware was 20 years old. So what are you building now at the European Space Agency that in 20 years' time we'll be going, whoa, that's cool?
We were just about to launch Pepe Colombo. That's going to Mercury. That's for me, actually one of the coolest looking spacecraft ever. Well, it's a group of spacecraft with the Japanese Space Agency as well. And so I'm lucky enough to see that because I work in ESTEC in the Netherlands, which is the test centre for ESA. So I've seen it, and it's this fantastic spacecraft covered in white MLI multi-layer insulation because it's going to go so close to the sun. That's being shipped out on 4 Antonovs in the next couple of weeks. So I think next week, actually, they'll start moving maybe the Japanese one because the Japanese are coming to ESA next week, and we're talking about something else. But that's a fantastic one. It gets launched this year. It takes about 7 years, I think, to get to Mercury. The Jupiter mission, JUICE, that's going to be launched in the early 20s. That will get to Jupiter when I'm ready to retire. So that's the problem with deep space missions. So astronomy missions, they take time, and also my background is in space plasma physics, so Earth magnetosphere, so the near-Earth stuff. Things are a bit quicker to get in orbit and start doing their science. It's the planetary exploration that takes a while. You know, there's a good question here about how long it takes to get to Mars, etc. So that's the problem with these missions, and why you spend a lot more time making sure they're going to work when you've sent them that far.
Awesome. Listen, thank you so much for talking to us, but mostly thank you for everything you've done with Rosetta. It was utterly mind-blowing. It was our Apollo, and just love it completely.
Thank you. I'm proud and honoured to work on it, basically, because it's not me, it's everyone. But yes, it's nice to talk to people that are enthused by it, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Matt mentioned Mark McCorcoran, and Mark is the Senior Advisor for Space and Exploration at the European Space Agency. I was under the impression that it was him that we had to thank for space rocks.
I will take full credit for the original idea. Yeah, I have a whiteboard at work where we do all sorts of interesting, you know, lots of people we've connected through Rosetta. And we had connected with Vangelis, and we had connected with various other artists that had written prog albums, symphonic suites, all off their own bat. They'd just done this. And at some point, I've always been a huge music fan. I thought, well, how can we now take this out of the sort of social media domain and make it physical, make it live, bring the, because we saw how much response this was getting, even at a distance. Can we bring people in the room? And we've all been giving talks over the years, but we'd never actually integrated the music and the space that way. So I had that idea. It's on my board. And I, through Matt Taylor, I met Alex. And Alex Milas is a big, he works in the music business, but is a big sci-fi fan and a big space fan. And it just was a, well, I had to say marriage made in heaven, but, you know, we have a, what do we, what's the phrase now? You don't have to be married to have a partnership. Anyway, all right, you know what I'm saying. And we've had this idea now running for more than 2 years. And there's all sorts of issues when you're in the European Space Agency, this idea of doing music events. It's all, ooh, a bit sniffy. Ooh, should we be doing that? And we've got a nice big legal agreement we had to put together. That took us 6 months to get all of that. But hey, look, I mean, it's all behind us. Here we are. We've done it. And we, you know, and so far we haven't blown the world up, I don't think, in terms of outreach.
So one of the ideas that I've heard on the stage a couple of times today that I'm most excited about is the Deep Space Gateway.
Yep.
Could you tell us a bit about that?
So everybody knows about the International Space Station, which is just 400 kilometres above the Earth, and it's been there for 20 years. It's got a natural life to it. It won't last forever. There's, you know, there's all sorts of thermal cycling happens. So there's an end to the ISS. You can't just keep refurbishing it. But also, there's a little bit mentioned there as well, this idea that people are... It's crazy to think of people being bored about a machine that goes around the world at 27,000 kilometres an hour. But, you know, there's that sort of sense that we've done that. Where do we go next? And if we want to go... To Mars, for example, as a medium-term goal, then going to the moon first and learning some of the lessons about being 3 days away from the Earth. Because from the ISS, you can come back in hours. If you have a real serious problem on board, you can be on the ground in hours. And so the sense of isolation, the sense of self-sufficiency at the space station isn't quite enough for going to Mars. So if we go to the space... go what's called cislunar space. So it's not orbiting around the moon directly, but orbiting in a big elliptical orbit which goes way out beyond the moon and comes back in again. And we can learn to operate there. It'll be a much smaller thing than the International Space Station, much more like a sort of Winnebago camper van or a, you know, a caravan you used to go to the beach with your shed. It's like living in your shed for a while, your cosmic shed. Send the astronauts there periodically. They won't live there permanently necessarily, but we can start to learn the lessons about how to go beyond, to go to Mars. So that's the idea now. Of course, there's the whole idea about going direct to Mars, but from our perspective and now from NASA's perspective, it's much more sensible to learn a bit closer to the Earth first than going straight to Mars.
Yeah. So you've said, I'm going to bring Stephen at this point. So Steve's a big Elon Musk fan, right?
Okay, right.
And he was a bit upset by your red car jibe. So, Steve...
Just to clarify, I think ESA are just as much rock stars as anyone else in the... I'm really interested in your opinion of the place for commercial operations in space, in getting us there and then once we're...
Well, look, you know, space has inherently been commercial from day one in the sense that we don't build rockets, Arianespace does. In the United States, NASA launches rockets with ULA... and with other companies, and now it uses Elon. I don't even like to say that. I mean, it's a company, SpaceX, right? And it's got an entrepreneur in the front of it, but there's an actual company. Glynn Shotwell runs the company day by day. She's the CEO. And they've done amazing things. Now, there's a huge range of commercial things that are done low Earth orbit, out at geostationary as well. I mean, you know, the whole of the telecoms industry, we might enable technology development, but on the other hand, it's commercial. So it's always been that connection. I think the thing that's becoming a bit more apparent now, though, is this discussion about entrepreneur-led people, you know, with many billions in the bank, not just Elon, of course, but Jeff Bezos as well, Blue Origin. This idea that they, because they're in the private arena, and because they need to raise money, because they need to get investors in, they're selling a vision. Okay. And that's a little harder for us because it's public money and we can't promise things we can't deliver. We have to excite people, we have to get people engaged, but we can't say, give us all this money and we will go and do this. And so for all that SpaceX have done amazing things in terms of technology, they, you know, they always deliver late. Now, so do we, of course. But we don't kind of get the get-out-of-jail-free card when that happens because it's public money and you've spent too much. So I'm going to go a bit dark on you now, right? I think also we're in a time, a little bit like the 1920s, where you had Carnegie, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Hearst. The idea of the incredibly rich person who's made money out of society, that they are now the saviors of society, and that the great rich individuals, the genius, the loner, the sort of Ayn Rand libertarian view that if you take government out of it, the rich will solve all of our problems. Well, we know where that ended up in the 1930s and 40s. So I think this lionization, this idolization of entrepreneurs has to be seen in this much bigger context, that they're operating in a time when the world is sort of becoming a bit driven by celebrity. And we're being made to look boring by this. And now, you know, we're doing cool things. We've actually been to Mars, right? So for all that we're talking about going to Mars, we've been there. So I find the dynamic an interesting one. So for me, when Falcon 9, when Falcon Heavy launched, seeing the two boosters come back, you know, it's pure Thunderbirds, right? You do have to ask why they came back. You know, what's the technology drive for having reusable boosters? It's actually about reusing rockets so many times that you can bring the cost of going to Mars down to a small amount. Our satellites cost so much, and this will sound terrible, and it'll come across wrong. The cost of the rocket doesn't matter very much because the actual satellite costs so much in the first place. Of course, it's still a lot of money by anybody's terms. So when they came back, I was inspired by that, but I felt a lot queasier about the whole business of sending a $100,000 car into space, the symbolism that as an entrepreneur I can just do this. All the stuff about concrete, you needed a mass dummy, or you could have had science experiments. It wasn't that at all. It was the semiotics of a culture where a €1,000, $1,000 car just becomes a PR stunt. In a world where, and I know it sounds bad, we spend lots of money, we live in a rich world, but that idea that was just a kind of an off-the-cuff, you know, bit of a moment. I watched lots of people on social media. Half thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, and half got quite upset about it. And upset's the wrong word, but I would certainly be in a camp where I thought, what sign is that actually selling about a world in which, you know, rich businessmen can just kind of do that as a stunt? So I think that's my nuance there. SpaceX doing brilliant things, but I just wonder a little bit about Elon sometimes in terms of the whole hype salesmanship thing. But he knows that. Right?
Yeah. I just want to pick you up on one thing you said there. There is nothing at all that could make Rosetta look boring, right? You said that it starts to make you look boring.
Well, I agree, but you know, I go out, I give lots of talks around Europe now, around the world, and I meet lots of 18-year-old kids who were 14 at the time of you know, landing on the comet. And I do occasionally get kind of the sneer where it's like, yeah, well, that's all very well, but, you know, Elon's cooler, right? SpaceX is cooler. And I'm interested by that dynamic because it's a storytelling thing. I mean, there's of course, if you're raising investment money, you've got to sell the big story. And we're bad at that, right? We're just a big government civil service organization. We can do the occasional cool thing, but it's not in our DNA in the way that it has to be if you're raising money. So I find that a bit disturbing that you've got 18-year-old kids saying that's the future, but governments aren't. Governments are, you know, it's boring. It's, you know, you're too, like the laws of physics apply to all of us in exactly the same way. And being able to discern between reality and fantasy and wishful thinking. It's the whole thing about I want to go to Mars to colonize. Do you really? Why do you want to go? What's the point of that? Oh, I want to escape from the Earth. Well, it's not going to be any better on Mars, I can assure you. It's going to be a lot worse. So there's a lot of wishful thinking going on and detachment from the real world we live in. And I find that whole dynamic quite fascinating as a sort of philosophical topic.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
If you're interested in that debate about the Tesla in space, you can hear an episode of the Physics World podcast about it, which I'll post a link to on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. We had a wonderful time at Space Rocks, and I know that they're planning to do it again with new guests and new music, and hopefully some of the same guests and some of the same music. I've suggested that they try and get Hannah Peel. I know they have to get Charlotte Hatherley back, but whatever they do, I know it will be awesome. Thank you so much to everyone for talking to us. All of this talk of Star Wars has reminded me that we've got something rather special planned for May the 4th. Stay tuned and follow at the Cosmic Shed on Twitter for more on that. I'll leave you with Dallas Campbell with Tim Peake on stage at the wonderful Space Rocks.
There are no guarantees that you're going to get to space. Even when you're selected as an astronaut, you've gone through all the basic training. So to actually get that phone call that says, you know what, you've just been assigned to a mission to space is the most incredible feeling.
Where were you when you were taking the call? Can you remember?
This is going to sound very cheesy.
Keep it clean.
It's going to sound very cheesy, but I had just got out of an Apache helicopter. I've been doing I just landed from one of the most amazing flights, because I didn't get to fly that much by then. Just landed, my phone went off, and it was Frank de Vim, Belgian astronaut, my boss at the time. He said, Tim, you've got me 2000.
Really? Were you kind of like heroically walking away from
the thing is, I wasn't allowed to tell anybody, so I was so excited, and all my army mates were thinking, what's he going to do?
Skipping that in your patch.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.